It's been fascinating to see how the world of conservative thought and conservative media has changed over the last 20 or so years. And in order to learn more about some of the trends, I decided to ask around. We'll get into it. Welcome to another episode of T-Rex Talk. And I have a guest today. The guest is Dr. Steve Turley, a man that I had to have on the show. Obviously, his podcast is called Turley Talks. We have T-Rex Talk. So obviously, we had to have a joint talk together. But Dr. Turley, could you just introduce yourself first? You have a pretty interesting and I would say extensive list of things that you have done in the past, but I would love to get your introduction in a nutshell direct from you. What are the salient points that you think you would want to bring to our audience?
Yeah, I'm always asked that, you know, if I go to the dentist or a doctor's appointment, whatever. So what do you do?
And my initial
reaction is I make videos. That's basically what I do. That's my daily. I read and I make videos. But yeah, the last, 3-4 years now, I've been full-time YouTube channel with over 1 million subscribers, where my shtick is I daily analyze current events in light of what I see as a new conservative civilizationalist world that's rising. So I give people, conservatives, hope and courage to faithfully live out in the present in light of even better things to come. Before that, I was in academia for 12 years or 20 years. And I wrote over 20 books on all kinds of civilizationalist themes, from politics to nationalisms, to the return of Christendom, the theology, aesthetics, education, art, beauty, and the like. So today I devote my time to bringing hope to courageous patriots all over the world with daily optimistic broadcasting and in light of what is admittedly a very crazy and turbulent age.
Yes. So the main conversation that I want to have with you, our audience, as you know, is particularly interested in the Second Amendment aspect of this. But we've talked about the importance of weapons and tools. Civilization is largely built on the capabilities of weapons and tools. And the weapons and tools that are popular, that are used, do indicate a huge, huge amount of the underlying culture of a civilization. Art and war are like these two sides of the same coin that represent what a culture does with its free time, what a culture is willing to die for, and they overlap as well. Some of the art that comes out of wars, some of the artistic craftsmanship that you see in weapons, there's a huge amount of overlap between these. So maybe we'll get there. But what I really wanted to talk to you about was you are relatively new to being a full-time video producer and cultural commentator, but you've also been around a while. You've been in academia for a while, and you've watched the conservative movement over the last 10 years. So what has changed? What is different? We were mentioning just earlier about just like when I was a kid, it was National Review, and then it was a bunch of guys on AM radio. Those were the conservative voices. And now it feels like there's just tons of them all over the place. Twitter, YouTube, there are, you know, Daily Blazes, Daily Beasts, Daily Wires, Daily Everythings, Breitbart, etc. You're doing daily stuff. The amount of conservative media that is available, even in the spite of the shadow bannings, throttlings, reduced visibilities, whatever the different platforms call their completely non-censorship based eyeball controls.
Yeah.
There are a lot of conservative voices out there, and that feels to me like a relatively new trend.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. So, you know, when Rush first came on the scene back in 1988, we literally lived in a very, very different world. I mean, the Soviet Union was still in power. The Berlin Wall was still up. And in 1991, that world, that Cold War, that bipolar world of two major superpowers collapsed, and we entered into what a lot of scholars refer to as a unipolar moment, where we were the only superpower on the planet. And you had scholars like Francis Fukuyama, to a certain extent, Charles Krauthammer, who are basically making the argument, this is our moment. Now we can reconfigure the world, recalibrate the world around American norms, geopolitical norms. And we had already been doing that to a certain extent in the what we call the Western worlds after World War II. After World War II, I mean, we were the only nation more or less that was standing after that. Japan was a wreck. Europe was a wreck. The Soviet Union was a wreck. And we were the only ones who were really able to build institutions that would create the rules to which all nations, if they wanted to prosper, if they wanted our protection, so forth, would abide by. Now, of course, the Warsaw Pact and Soviet Union created its own world, but we created a world of, you know, International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization alike. And after 1991, those institutions became the official international institutions for a rules-based order.
And we sweetened the pot so that when countries would pick between the Warsaw Pact and this giant socialist expansionist machine, there was also this, you know, very non-communistic country over here that had a whole bunch of free money and free protection for trade. And not all of it was completely free, but a lot of it was, you know, largely funded by the U.S. These rule-based systems had a lot of carrots attached to them.
Absolutely. I just asked Saudi Arabia, right? You know, just creating the petrodollar and all that. I mean, that world provided the model for what a unipolar world would look like. And it was, interestingly enough, I tend to follow Sam Huntington on this, Samuel Huntington of Harvard University, the author of Clash of Civilizations thesis. I tend to follow his lead on this. I would agree that that was a highly ideological age. In other words, it was an age just going back to the bipolar era in the Cold War. It fundamentally came down to, what do you believe? Are you a communist, or are you a capitalist? Do you believe in democracy, or do you believe in more totalitarianism? What is your ideology? What do you believe in? And even when Rush came on the scene, I mean, he spent a lot of time explaining to people what is a conservative and what is a conservative Republican, and how is it that what we believe in is fundamentally different from what these crazy, wacky left-wing Democrats believe in. Like, remember Dick Gephardt and all those guys. So, and that was Rush's brilliance, and he was able to do that better than anyone else. But what Huntington argued in the early 90s is that, as people like Frank Fukuyama were arguing, this is the end of history. The world had finally come and arrived to the single one-size-fits-all universal political ideology, which we would call liberalism, and liberalism not in terms of left-wing, but liberalism in terms of the political notion of the restraint of executive power in order to maximize human freedom. That would be basically the 18th-century political liberal ideal that links together all Western liberals, whether you're on the left or the right. That notion, that conception that was going to be the number one universal political system, economic system for all people's times and places, that was very popular. That conception was very popular in the 1990s. You had someone like Sam Huntington said, no, you don't understand. That's not what's happening here. We haven't reached the end of history. We're actually reaching the end of liberalism. We're actually reaching the end of modernity. Liberalism's rooted in this deeper conception known as modernity, going back to the 18th century Enlightenment, which basically argued that scientific rationalism was the one true way of understanding reality. Religion just was no longer necessary anymore. All the Enlightenment figures spoke religiously because that was the only philosophical idiom that they could use.
It was the vocabulary, yeah.
That was the vocabulary that exactly, just like the early church used, you know, Greco-Roman vocabulary, philosophical categories and so on. But at 19th century, Industrial Revolution, 20th century, social revolutions, eventually society became radically secularized, and the notion was that scientific rationalism can provide the one true political and economic system that was transferable all over the world. It didn't matter what culture you belong to or what religion, because culture and religion are irrelevant today. All that matters are systems, political systems, economic systems, and liberalism, capital L, was going to be the one dominant world, one dominant political and economic worldview for all people. What you had with Sam Huntington is an argument that said that the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of fascism prior to that were both indicators that this universalistic conception that there is a one size fits all political and economic system for all people, that itself was collapsing. And it's only a matter of time before liberalism and its ideology, its universalistic ideology, collapses as well. That's the era we're finding ourselves in today. I think that is pretty much that prophecy back in the early 90s from Sam Huntington, that has been fulfilled. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing conservatism not so much as an ideology as an identity. So that's that was Sam Huntington's thesis. We're moving from ideology to identity. That's the clash of civilizations thesis. In other words, all the great clashes of the 20th century were ideological. Fascism versus liberal democracy and communism. Then liberal democracy versus communism and all that. But now it's going to be Ukrainians versus Russians, or it's going to be Slavs versus Croats, or it's going to be the Houthis versus the larger Yemeni population. Everywhere you look now, and it's going to be BLM versus Christian nationalists. It's going to be everywhere you look, you're going to start to see clashes around identities as opposed to ideologies. Why? Because there is no universal ideology anymore. Right. It's basically collapsed.
Yeah, which definitely, I think is highlighted. We were talking about National Review and, William F. Buckley and all of his guys wrote about ideologies. Obviously, they were identified as conservatives by the legacy media. Like, these guys are the conservatives. They're the only ones. They were they were pigeonholed. Right. Their identity was conservative, but they wrote about ideas. They didn't write about a specific type of identity. And now, when you look at the new conservative commentators on the internet, it is much more of an identitarian thing. Yes. And it is interesting how that has developed. I do feel like we're missing some of the ideological side. And it almost feels like I know that a lot of people feel that it is unnecessary because the existing alternative ideologies that are out there are so ridiculous and they're producing such ridiculous results that, we don't need to write a book about the failings of this over here. It's just turn on liberals of Reddit.
Right. Yeah.
And so I think that there is a lack of ideological rigor because we're getting a little tribalistic. And I think that does explain why there are so many different conservative voices on the internet. And what holds us together is that we think the clown world is clowns.
Yes.
And that we've identified ourselves as conservatives in some way. But even that phrase is, losing a little bit of clarity and meaning. So what's coming?
Yeah, I think the word traditionalist is actually being used more often than conservative at this point, because that's what holds, say, a Hindu conservative together with a Texan conservative, or, a Russian Orthodox conservative with a Nigerian conservative. They're traditionalists. They're going back to their nation, culture, customs, traditions, particularly the religious traditions, as frames of reference that enable them to flourish in the present and the future. I mean, that's basically what a traditionalist is one who believes in institutions, beliefs, and practices of the past that they consider to be indispensable in the present for human flourishing in the future. So it binds past, present, and future together, which stands in stark contrast to the modernists. The modernists tend to see anything in the past as primitive and knuckle-dragging and no longer relevant to a brave new world. So there was a radical break from the past. Anything that's traditional is by definition passé and irrelevant. So I like using the the modern movie theater, which is itself ironically becoming more and more extinct as streaming.
It's true, yeah.
Right, but if you go into a movie theater, it's an incredible, iconic experience. I mean, there's posters everywhere, images everywhere, but you'll notice they're always the future. It's never the past. It's unless, again, unless they're having some retrograde.
An art movie house theater. Yeah.
Exactly, like Casablanca's 50th anniversary or something akin to that. But it's always, there are advertisements that are always trying to get you back by promoting the new and the novel. And what traditionalism is it's this notion that while the future is extremely important, I mean, we're all going to be living there. We're going to spend the rest of our lives in the future. You can't negate the past. And the reason for that is because tradition exemplifies eternity. Tradition is ironically transtemporal. All the great traditions in some way, shape, or form apply to any age precisely because they transcend any age. So that's what the true, the good, and the beautiful are so wonderful about. And again, this is where ideology does come in, because ideology is trying to identify the true, the good, and the beautiful, those things that are sort of the first principles that are the foundation for a flourishing life, regardless of the age you're living
right.
in. So that's the traditionalism we're all kind of going back to in some ways. So that's why scholars refer to what we're seeing here in the United States and the Brexit movement in Britain, or the new right that we're seeing pop up all throughout Europe, or the rise of the Orthodox Church in Russia, Hindu nationalism in India, and so on. They refer to it as civilizationalist populism. And it's this notion that borders matter, economy matters, culture matters. All of these things matter. And when you put border, economy, and culture together, you do get a kind of the basic frames of reference for civilization. But our leaders have sold us out. They've sold us out to this ideological globalism, this one-size-fits-all political and economic system being governed from the top down, you know, classic, you know, WEF kind of stuff. And
yes, all stuff that didn't used to be believable in a bad movie, guy in a leather.
Exactly.
And that would have been standing key, around.
And that would have been the key difference between, say, like a Rush Limbaugh and an Alex Jones, right? Alex Jones really went there very early on before everyone else, and saw this more in this clash of civilizations kind of way, with alternative explanations to how to fit life events together and so forth. Regardless, that would be, I think, we're all a bit more Alex Jones today than we than Rush Limbaugh, because we do recognize the world in this clash of civilization sense.
Yeah, if you had asked me in 1990s, like, would we look back on Rush Limbaugh, this guy who had these hilarious sayings and these Paul Shanklin parody songs, like, would we look back on him as this distinguished guy with a lot of gravitas? And
right.
No, we would not. And yet here we are. We look back on Rush Limbaugh as this old-fashioned sort of guy.
And the other thing... We were talking before the interview, which is so cool, is that Rush did recognize, unlike a lot of people say at National Review, Rush did recognize this change. He did see that politics were becoming much more populist. They were becoming much more anti-political elite. The animosity wasn't so much horizontal, left versus right, Democrat versus Republican, as it would have been in 1991. Now the animosity is becoming more and more vertical. It's the people versus the permanent political class, the ruled versus the rulers, and he recognized that, to his credit. And that just, to me, that just shows what an astute observer he was of political life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it is really fascinating. I do think that there's a whole bunch of threads to pull right at this moment. But in the gun community, the wider sort of Second Amendment community, there is very much a definite, I don't even know how to put it exactly, but there definitely is a sense of this is civilization level stuff.
Yeah.
And things are so crazy on one side that the ideology doesn't matter a lot. And I see a bit of a weakness with pure traditionalism. And that mm-hmm. is that traditionalism also doesn't require an ideology. It just requires nostalgia plus mm-hmm. something now to compare with nostalgia. And I think that is a distinct weakness where traditionalism will give us a whole list of things that we should run away from and not engage with, and that's good, but it doesn't really give us the way to develop, say, a sound economic policy or the way that we actually want to develop civilization in the future. Obviously, we theoretically could go back to the 1500s and do things the 1500s way, and if we actually did that, maybe we could build those 1500s cathedrals again, but we'd probably have the 30 years war again, and we'd probably have the plague again. Like, obviously, we want to figure out and distill what are the things that build civilization in there and build on those rather than just be a pure traditionalist where it's like return to monkey or some of the other memes.
Can I push back on that a little?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Swinging on trees. There you go. How traditionalist do you want? I'm more traditionalist than you are. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of hilarious. That return to monkey meme is like, all right, so you know that Darwinism was what brought us this whole past is evil, future is good, order of chaos
exactly.
assumption.
That's
you're playing into their hands, man.
Exactly. No,
but go on.
I think that's a bit of a mischaracterization of the traditionalism that's being promoted in Russia today and in Iran and India and Saudi Arabia. Shinto Japan, Confucian China. Ironically, they're some of the most technologically advanced cultures mm-hmm. right now, particularly Japan. So what's actually it's a rediscovery of what Jordan Peterson would refer to as a nation's logos or a people's logos. You know, it's their, well, Guillaume Fay called it their archos. It's that which it's an ancient eternal principle that holds your people together. So constitutionally, I mean, we're touching on that, aren't we? When we're talking mm-hmm. about how our rights aren't granted to us by some landowner, by some duke or some noble or some
careful
lord.
Now, you're sounding very Christian nationalist. At this point, but go on.
Right, that's right. Isn't that fascinating? We're that far gone now that to say my rights are inalienable precisely because they are uncaused. They don't have a historical contingent. They may have been discovered historically and culturally, but they're reflective of an eternal, transcendent, divine order of which I'm an image. And then the government simply is there in order to protect that, ironically, right? So it's really getting back in touch with that archos or that logos of what holds us together as a people that got buried under layers and layers of modernity that said all you need is scientific rationalism and nothing more. There's all kinds of problems with that because scientific rationalism is rooted in doubt and skepticism mm-hmm. to its credit. That's what makes it so good. So how do I know? You got to prove it to me. But then it was thought in the 18th and 19th century that if you dispelled that doubt and skepticism through the scientific method, somehow a doubt and skepticism would disappear. And we didn't realize that you don't have to be much of a genius to figure out that if your worldview is rooted in doubt and skepticism, pretty soon that doubt and skepticism is going to be turned on the worldview itself. And that's how we end up from modernity to post-modernity now. And that's what we see with BLM and everything like that. Everything is racist. Everything is white supremacy, blah, blah, blah. And so it's this notion that no matter what claim you make to the true, the good, and the beautiful, that's just some disguised political power ploy and nothing more. And so what traditionalism is, it's a rediscovery of the archos of a people that's been covered up over by centuries of modernity, but for the purpose of being able to take where we are technologically to a new level. So that's why Guillaume Fay refers to it as archaeofuture. That's where we're going. Or you might have even heard the term techno-primitivism. Mm-hmm. Ironically, it's Saudi Arabia, it's Iran, it's India, it's China, it's Russia, it's Japan that are producing some of the most technologically advanced things on the planet right now. We're falling way behind. We're falling behind because we're still stuck in modernity, and the modernist worldview is crumbling as we speak. So ironically, tradition is becoming a means to kind of reawaken technological innovation. But where modernity split tradition and technology, meaning that they had, you know, science and religion had nothing to do with each other, a postmodern world is bringing tradition technology together. I like to say, so we end up more like Star Wars than Star Trek, right? So Star Trek is totally secularized. There's no mysticism, nothing like that. Whereas Star Wars is all the tech of Star Trek, but rooted in extraordinary sense of mysticism.
Yeah. And one of the things that sort of I found very fascinating when I was young, and I was very much into Star Wars as a kid, this idea that there was this past civilization. You know, the lightsaber was is the weapon of a previous greater time, and primitive blasters have come afterwards. That always like got me as a kid. I was like, how can you lose a civilization? And I was like, oh no. I get it now.
I see it now. Yeah, look, again, go visit San Francisco, right?
I mean, I can visit San Francisco.
I can see it in real time.
So here's a question. Here's a question for traditionalism. So one of the dangers is that you lose a lot of your traditions because so much of your culture is stripped away. So not only in San Francisco, but other places, like we have people tearing down statues. We have 150 years of people inside public school systems being taught revisionist history. Like, now I'm not pessimistic about this. I have a whole shelf full of books. All my favorite theologians are from the 1600s. All those books are not only in print now, but the public domain means they're all free on Gutenberg. Like, we have tremendous capacity to go back, but I also feel like we're missing a big chunk of the middle. Like, we've had so much of the 1950s and the 1930s and the late 1800s completely revised, historically speaking. So our traditionalism is kind of disconnected, and we can go back a ways, which I'm not opposed to. I love reading Puritan theologians, but that's a big step for somebody who has just decided, like, oh, San Francisco is terrible now. Let's go back to Cotton Mather. That's a big step.
That's right. And God's law. And yes. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. No, what you're saying is precisely the kind of conversation that civilizationalists all over the world are having. And the university, ironically, is the Johnny come lately on this. The literature on civilizationalism is only about 4 years old. It's a very, very new discipline. The conversations were being had among guys like us on social media, it's more the right wing media, print media and the like. Nigel Farage likes to say that he learned more about Brexit by visiting pubs, his local pub, than listening to the BBC. The BBC had no idea what was going on behind Brexit, right? this civilizationalist populism that was rising up. But you got an earful over a swift half of Bass Ale in a pub, and I think that's the kind of conversations. It's basically, it works like this, if I could kind of reduce it to this. Okay, we're in India, and we got colonized. We turned our country into a formal country in, what was it, 1947, after the partition of Pakistan. And then we were basically ruled for the next 40 or 50 years by every single member of our Indian parliament. All were educated in England. They all got degrees from a British university, and then came back and basically ruled us with this common law, British law structure. And we've lost what it really means to be Hindu, what it really means to be Indian. What if we could go back to right around where we lost it and pick up again? Where would we go from there? The Russian Orthodox Church did something very much like this. So by 1917, 1918, you know, we all of a sudden have to go underground. We get persecuted. We went from 60,000 churches at our height at, say, 1915, 1916, by the time halfway through Stalin, we're down to 2,000 churches. 1,000 monasteries disappeared. They're all gulags. That's what makes books like, you know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich so fascinating. It depicts experience and life of these gulags, but it's an old monastery. So you see flashes of divine grace, even in the midst of the darkest moments of life. In other words, we may have left God, but he never left us, kind of theology, which is beautiful. So what did the Russian Orthodox Church do with Yeltsin coming in and then with Putin coming in 2000? It was like, okay, well, where were we back in 1915? Well, we had 60,000 churches, 1,000 monasteries. All right, let's get those monasteries back. Let's start building churches again. And so retraditionalization is really, it's a very interesting thought experiment that basically says, let's go back to where things first started going awry and let's kind of imagine they didn't. Where would we be right now? What would our nation look like? And that's the thought experiments that are happening among civilizationalists today. And then they get enacted into policy in different ways. The Modi government in India is instituting Hindutva, particularly throughout their schools. We're seeing that also with, you mentioned evolution. We're seeing with President Erdogan in Turkey passing a law no longer teaching evolution. They only teach intelligent design in Turkish schools. So you're starting to see some really interesting, and again, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. So this is descriptive.
This is the movement. Yeah.
This is the move. This is what's happened. Whether you like it or not, it's totally irrelevant. This is where the world is going. It's going back, and it's going back to the time they felt like things started moving in a wrong direction. And okay, from there, how, you know, what could we have learned from where it turned, particularly technologically? And then from there, where can we now pick up with the great civilizationalist conversation and project we've been doing for a lot of people? Well, if you're doing with India or China, you're talking 3,000 years. In many ways, what's happening in Israel and Palestine right now, the Palestinians, is very much
very traditional
flash. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's I think it's impossible to understand their rhetoric and their mutually exclusive rhetoric without understanding it in civilizationalist terms.
Yeah, our family is reading through we read the Exodus and now we're going through just some of the rest of the story before Joshua, and it's like, hey, this also happened last week. This happened in Numbers chapter whatever. It also is happening this month. So it is kind of interesting to see that. Extremely fascinating. And I am curious just kind of to see how this plays out. I'm fascinated. I have a lot of thoughts and opinions about India that are largely uninformed. But I am, obviously, America is much closer to home, and I feel much more plugged into American cultures and communities, different sub-communities and subcultures. And then I also know American history better. So where do traditionalists think we went off the rails, if you could boil it down?
That's going to be part of asking Northern traditionalists versus Southern traditionalists. That's where it gets.
There's a bunch of people in the South who are like, well, it was the 1860s.
You got it. Yeah. I think generally speaking, there is a sense that something where everyone does agree is something went awry post-World War II. Prior to World War II, we were pretty isolationist in many respects. I would say World War I, but the interregnum between World War I and World War II, that was really more, I mean, it was kind of a, you know, the roaring 20s, what you had, the Great Depression, that was rough. But generally speaking, the 20s were, I mean, we've arrived, we've got money, we don't have to bother with anything. And then the World War II comes in, Depression comes in, and there was this notion that our leaders are no longer our representatives anymore after that. they now are the rulers of the world. It didn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, just didn't matter. Your number one goal when you won a federal office is implementing a rules-based order that would, at least at its promise, would never allow another Hitler to emerge again and would protect our nation from a red scare that wants to bury us, as Khrushchev would say, because of this ideological dialectical materialism that says, hey, it's just a matter of time before you guys get subsumed into this communist utopia. So we built a national security state over a course of 40 or 50 years that, with the fall of the Soviet Union, basically flexed its muscle around the world. My wife's from Japan, and you know, if you ever want an earful of how America is a bully, listen to Japanese. They see it. They're for right or for wrong. You know, it's again, descriptively, people feel like they just get bullied all the time by the United States. And Mark Twain once said, you can't be an empire abroad and a republic at home. Eventually, that tyrannical sort of despotism is going to make its way back home. And that's what I think we're experiencing right now. Where Joel Kotkin of Chapman University refers to it as neo-feudalization or re-feudalism. We're basically experiencing this union between billionaires and bureaucrats like we've never seen before. Not unlike the feudal era, where a tremendous amount of power is in the hands of very few. And then what they do is they enforce that power, not just through rules and regulations, but through a fundamentalist ideology, the ideology of wokeness, that's being enforced not so much by a clerical class, but now by a clerisy class, a class of pseudo-intellectuals of the universities. And the idea there is wokeness ultimately hollows us out morally. It hollows us out institutionally in terms of our mediating institutions like family. Remember, BLM wanted to get rid of the nuclear family. It hollows out community. It hollows out the church. It hollows out everything so that it's just me as a consumer in this mass cog of consumption. And so I basically live to enrich those billionaires and bureaucrats, enrich and empower those billionaires. So I think a lot of it, certainly this has been Pat Buchanan's sustained argument for decades now, that's the post-World War II rules-based order where America stopped being a republic and became an empire. And I think we could agree there that that's where things really started going wrong at all kinds of levels.
Yeah, no, I agree that the wheels are really coming off around that time. But you can kind of trace it back before.
No question.
President McKinley.
Farther back you trace
stuff we were doing. Yeah.
Yeah, the farther back you trace it, the more now you're going to get kind of the divergent strands.
But that turn of the century right there is just such an amazing time. Yeah. You go from the world really hasn't changed all that much in thousands of years to all of a sudden it's cars, airplanes. Steam has been around for a while, but you don't really see the effects of the steam engine until right there at the turn of the century. Oh, quick book recommendation. It's very interesting to read. This is not a political theorist. You've probably heard of this guy. John Buchan was a man who fought in World War I. He was in the British government, and he wrote 5 spy novels. They're almost like predecessor to James Bond. And, you know, Fleming fought in World War II. This guy fought in World War I. His first book is The 39 Steps, which Hitchcock turned into a spy movie.
Oh, neat.
But his books depict before, during, and after World War I. And there are aspects of this book and the culture, he just writes about it so matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
In some ways, it is one of the most familiar cultures that he describes and the most alien at the same time. Because it's right at that turn of the century where he is a South African Boer. He's a traditionalist through and through. He comes from a world that hasn't seen a lot of change, and there's just nothing but change. Or going to war and his very old school wilderness scouting experiences are still applicable, but there's all this new technology. And then there's all these new ideas. And then after the war, there's all this fallout and people are not really sure like how this is working. And so it's interesting.
it is so fascinating because you do see the rise of a new class known as the technocratic class, or literally a ruling class, where the more technological society becomes, this is critique going back to the 1920s and 30s, where scholars recognize the more technocratic our society becomes, the more it becomes dependent on technocrats. And technology, by definition, involves control. So technocrats, you see, are in charge of control. And then it goes a step further. C.S. Lewis talked about this in his Abolition of Man, which is a nice book recommendation as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, where he argued that the evil genius of the technocrat is convincing the masses that you're most free when the technocrats are most in control.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a whole different world than even the original feudalized world of the medieval period, which has extraordinary freedoms in comparison to the technocratic age, which becomes really totalitarian.
And I feel like we're at not exactly a crossroads, but when you see some of the technological developments that are happening in the early 1900s, they are all double-edged swords. Like a steam engine is a thing that you and your neighbors can use to drastically output the crops, the amount of acreage that you can now till and the amount of crops that you can actually harvest and process goes way up. And you can buy those things as a small community of farmers, as a town, or you can let a big corporation that owns a gigantic railroad that they got from government land grants there are ways in which it can go. And I see that happening now with 3D printers and 3D scanners and small desktop CNC machines. At T-Rex, we do a lot of, I would say, pretty low level manufacturing, but we're doing it with pretty advanced digital manufacturing tools now. And it can easily be a thing that you bring into your home. Like, you can do super advanced stuff in a cottage industry setting. Like, in an actual cottage, you could have pretty advanced manufacturing capability. But there is a temptation to be like, no, I don't want the 3D printer that I calibrate myself. I want the one that connects to the cloud and it automatically does the thing and it's automatically subscribes to the pellets and they arrive and this happens and I have this other thing and I pay to unlock features and I'm tied into a large centralized control mechanism. The temptation is there to go the easy route or to actually master the fundamentals, which in my opinion is one of the main things traditionalists should look back to, old school craftsmen who mastered fundamentals and didn't chase the froth on the top of the wave, like the trends, but who actually mastered the fundamentals. And if you can do that with some of these new modern tools, it's incredibly powerful and you retain all of this freedom to do whatever you want.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I there's so much what you just said there. So when, the servile arts, that complemented the liberal arts. Yeah. One way of schematizing it is in terms of classical concepts of knowledge, where they believed knowledge was manifold. It was very pluralistic in many respects, but you could organize it around three main kinds of knowledge: theoria, scientia, and praxis. And the difference is theoria is really, in many respects, kind of a wisdom, a divine knowledge. You're talking about reading the Book of Exodus. That's theoria. It's seeing the true, the good, and the beautiful that are eternally relevant. Scientia is problem solving. If all I'm doing is studying theoria, and I've got a family I need to feed, they're going to be like, hey, yo, dad, hello here. Yeah. Do you know how to make a fire? Do you know how to keep us warm? I mean, scientia is basic structural problem solving. Obviously, we get the word science from it. And it can be very, very theoretical. I mean, physics is like that. Physics has a theoria, a theory, at the highest level, and E=mc², but then it applies it to the material world. That's just that hierarchical structure of life. But then there is praxis, and praxis is a knowledge of the world through what you do with stuff. So it's like we don't just know what a tree is from meditating on a theology of treeness, you know, the trees in the Garden of Eden, the cross is the tree of life returned. That's all wonderful. It's amazing. But we don't just analyze it, in terms of the biology of a tree either, or horticulture through Scientia. We also know what a tree is based on what we do with it. Do we climb it? Do we cut it down? Do we turn it into a chair? Do I decorate it around December 25th? And so that's proxies. Proxies means I know through manipulation. Scientia, I know through problem solving and categorization. And theoria, I know literally through prayer and worship and mystical experience. And the cool thing was they realized that theoria was necessary in order to prevent scientia from falling into pure manipulation. When you get rid of theoria, all you have then is scientia and proxies. And so science is there solely at the service to manipulate and coerce. That's it. Mm-hmm. And that's the world we're living in, you see.
Right, yeah.
So we need that theoria. We need that traditionalism, that civilizationalism, so as ironically to enable our technologies to become as flourishing and as human-affirming as the theoria itself. So, I mean, when you were talking there, I just had all these thoughts jumping around in my head going, oh, I love this. This is when I do miss academia, being able to talk about this more and more with students and the like. So that was awesome.
Yeah. Well, and the fun part is, this is an area where I feel like there can be the largest break from academia, the flawed academia that we have now. At our shop, we have three engineers, but only one of them has a degree. We've discovered that so much of this stuff is, you know, you can learn this stuff yourself. You can experiment, and there's YouTube tutorials.
Don't go to universities. They're worth it.
Exactly.
A waste of time. Yeah,
and so I feel like a sort of a winnowing is happening where COVID did this to some extent, where it filtered people out of certain institutions, and some of that was on purpose. But I feel like it also filtered a lot of good people out of universities to the point where the sort of people that you don't want to waste 4 years here are exactly the kind of people who are no longer wasting 4 years there.
Right.
Yes. And so it is fascinating. I do think there needs to be a lot more encouragement in there because in the sort of DIY maker space, there definitely is more of a trend toward, I don't know how I describe it, like the Burning Man types, you know, sort of neo-paganists are very much into some of these technologies and Christian traditionalists who have previously been the drivers of so many areas of technology and craftsmanship in the past really need to not get left behind.
Right.
Because there's all these golden opportunities that are there to provide for families and to build civilization.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's that archaeo-future paradigm. Yeah. I know there's attractiveness. I live in right outside of Lancaster County. So I've got the Amish not too far away from me here. So there could be a little attraction to go back to, you know, the 19th century way. But ironically, even the Amish have to wrestle with this. Amish have Blackberries. Amish have smartphones. Depends on just what the ordnung is, the order of Amish you're in. None of them are generally, they're not allowed in their home. The home is a sacred place and so forth. But for work and so forth, counting and say, they use this. So they have to wrestle with the same thing. So even if you were to go full blown Amish, you're still wrestling with the same thing, granted in a different degree, but you're still wrestling with the same issue of tradition, technology.
Yeah. And as much as I find the olden times attractive, it's only parts of it. I still like 21st century dentistry. In fact, there's medical technologies. I'm like, can that come quicker? You know, I feel my age.
Exactly.
Like, could we stop all this government nonsense? I'd like the free market to improve the science. Yeah. I'm really not anti medical science. I'm anti this politicalization of medical science.
Big pharma, big med, and all that. Exactly. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done. And it's just fascinating to me, the opportunities that that we do have. And it does feel like so many times in history when technology, a new technological wave happens, the printing press, the steam engine, gunpowder, and these are all these double-edged swords that could be used one way or another. The internet.
Yeah.
Can you remember the internet in the early days?
Yeah.
Yeah. Internet in the early days was so decentralized. It was so, so free. There were no, there were no centralized control figures. Now it's like, there's three companies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It seems like it's, well, especially with the internet 3.0, with the blockchain as it's getting developed, and that's when we're going to finally see that. It looks like blow apart because it's going to be an ownership based internet. So right now, the way it's been presented to me, I thought was brilliant is YouTube is a lot like China. So the Chinese Communist Party basically owns everything, and they tell you you can flourish if you play by our rules. You can make as much money as you want. You can do as much. You can reach all these people. You can do amazing things in the Chinese system. But we own it. We can pull the plug anytime we want. And that's basically YouTube. That's it. Yeah. That's basically Facebook. That, you know, that's, I mean, even Elon Musk is talking about turning Twitter X more into a blockchain technology where you actually own your account, you own your subscribers, you own your email list and the like. But I think what we're seeing today is something very interesting. You mentioned the printing press. You know, last time we had a feudalized society, it got blown apart by the Protestant Reformation. Protestant Reformation, in many respects, was a populist movement. It was it was an anti-clerical movement, an anti.
That's why I have all these books from the 1600s.
It's so neat because, in many respects, I see civilizationalist populism as a kind of reformation. You even have this notion of restoration politics. This is something that Erdogan talks a lot about in Turkey, but it's again the same idea of. Okay, let's imagine going back to before things got all messed up. How do we restore those conditions so as to be able to move forward, but this time on the right path? And so I think what's happening today is just like you had the printing press back in the day that spread Reformation ideas like wildfire. Now you've got the internet and the network society that's spreading civilizationalist ideas like wildfire, and it's by its nature is decentralizing. Even if it still is controlled by, you know, big three or four big tech conglomerates, nevertheless, the beauty, you know, you look at what we've done to the legacy media. I mean, CNN and MSNBC, they're just, it's almost kind of sad. I always found Biden as being this interesting symbol of the modern age in general, just this decrepit, you know, cognitively declining system that it's just kind of hard to look at because it takes itself so seriously and yet nobody else does. And so you look at CNN, you look at even Fox News to a certain extent, and you realize, wait a minute now, every time there's a breaking story anywhere in the world, the first images always come back from somebody's smartphone. It's not from some satellite truck like in Die Hard, you know, where they show her, right? And where they're listening to the police.
Opportunities. Yeah, the opportunities for decentralization are immense.
Immense.
We carry with us these incredible decentralizing tools that all go through these centralized companies.
Exactly.
It's very hard to think about how you would separate them in from, you know, a low level technical perspective. But like, I feel like we're just right on the edge of so many unique opportunities.
Yes, absolutely.
So now, that being said, it requires that people do an awful lot of work, and it does require an ideological, I think it does require truth, because the Chinese actually had printing presses, working printing presses. It's a little more complicated because of the typology that they had at the time. But they had working movable block printing presses in the 1100s and the 1010s, and they didn't use those to decentralize. They didn't use those for freedom. Right. They used those to create anti-counterfeiting government edicts. You couldn't counterfeit this because the printing presses were controlled by the emperor's dudes. And so there's another example. You the technology isn't enough by itself. It really has to be wielded by people that have that really do have an ideological reason for what they did. I mean, the Protestant Reformation is such a fascinating time of history, and it kicks off this immense fruitfulness. But at the same time, it was no picnic. I don't want to live in those days and deal with that kind of the cost of decentralizing some of those things was enormous. Now, the benefits for the following generations were also incalculable. But that is the which way modern man meme. Like, would you like all these things for your grandchildren? Here's what it's going to cost you. Would you like to enjoy the last gasp of fun and games from Rome? Or would you like to go build something way up in the hinterlands and chop down the oak trees of the Vikings and fight them for 50 or 60 years so that your grandkids can build something better?
Yes.
That's kind of the place where I feel like we're at.
I think you're right. I mean, Peterim Sorokin, who's a Russian-American sociologist, he founded the sociology department in Harvard back, I think, in the 40s or 50s. But that's his theory of society, which is very, very... He wasn't read for ages. During our modern unipolar moment, everyone just threw him away because he kept arguing that inevitably decrepit societies end up going back to their sacred sources. So he always saw religious renewal as inherent to any society. And he just wrote so extensively and brilliantly on multiple civilizations, going all the way back to the ancient Egyptians and their revival of religiosity, to the Hebrews, to, you know, the Greco-Roman world, Christians, Indians, Chinese, you name it. Brilliant scholar. And his basic thesis is that all civilizations are religious. They're all rooted in some kind of sacred, some kind of absolute, unquestionable source of life. That's an inexhaustible fountain of life in some way, shape, or form. But then all those societies always have some kind of secular outworking as well. We need to know how to eat. We need to know how to build things. We need to know how to fight war. Just very similar to how you just started the whole conversation here. The techniques of survival, in effect, he would label that as sensate or secular in our word. Mm-hmm. And for a while, the religious is able to sanctify the sensate. So we think, you know, we'll pray over a meal, or so we'll pray before a hunt. We'll see the house as a little church. All of our secular activities always have some sacredness to it. But what he noticed is that what he called the sacred tropes, these eternal, true, good, and beautiful, we can even call them ideological tropes, that provide the foundation for secular topoi, oftentimes those topoi, as he called it, plural of topos, those topoi sort of sever themselves from the sacred tropes so that they become self-referential. So now I go to a science lecture and theology is completely thrown out, or I go to a law lecture and canon law, which is the precursor to our civil law, completely thrown out. We don't need recourse to that anymore.
Right,
the problem, though, is it's severed itself off from that eternal source of life that, even someone like Jordan Peterson is talking about, is absolutely necessary for a flourishing civilization, that logos, that archon. And so eventually those secular topoi begin to erode. They begin to collapse under their own weight. And in effect, they almost become like a compost rotting pile that then reawakens those sacred seeds again. The sacred never completely disappears. It was always there. It was hidden for a while. But like we saw with the Orthodox Church in Russia after 70 years, or we're seeing with the renewed Brahmin Hinduism in India, or the renewed Ottoman sensibilities in Turkey, and on and on, and the indigenous religions in Africa, or even just the massive Christian conversions that are happening there. Whatever it is, and I would argue here in the United States, particularly in red states, we're seeing a reemergence now of those original sacred seeds, as it were, that gave birth to the civilizations that we all love, and then particularly the civilization that we call home. So for Sorokin, the future is religious. It's really fascinating thesis.
Yeah, well, we've, I would say even in the little microcosm of the gun community, T-Rex is 10 years old. For the last 7 or 8 years, I've been going to SHOT Show, I think, or 6 or 7. And even in those last 6 or 7 years, I can see this very interesting progression. There's cultural progressions, as in what's interesting, what's cool. But I also see that there has been this this sort of move back towards Christianity. And it isn't because Christianity has become cooler in the last 5 or 6 years. The media certainly hasn't said that. The institutions have not come to that conclusion. But I think people have butted their heads up against the alternatives. And decided, like, oh, after postmodernism comes nihilism. Not cool. We're gonna take this other path. People that I know who have flirted with neo-paganism have sort of figured out, like, oh, you know what pagans do best is convert to Christianity.
That's right.
And so I even met a guy at SHOT Show this past January who he is a non-Christian Christian nationalist. Sort of believes in God.
Yeah.
Doesn't believe in the Bible.
Right.
But he does believe our laws really need to be based on the Bible, because that's what the founders did. So it was neat talking to him. I was like, I need to take you to the Southern Baptist Convention, because you're going to blow some people's minds.
Well, you know, even Richard Dawkins has referred to himself as a cultural Christian.
Right.
So you're not going to get a more, you know, staunch atheistic stance than Richard Dawkins. And yet even he recognizes that
this is good stuff.
That his imagination has been inordinately shaped by 1500 years of Christendom. There's just no way around it. And
the alternative is unpleasant.
He's seeing it. He's seeing it. You're always going to have a religion. There's no way around it. You're always going to have a sacred. And you're seeing this very vicious wokeness rise up that is tribalism on steroids when all is said and done. That's all wokeness actually is. It's taking this move to identity, it's taking the shattered shards of modernity and globalism that have divorced identity from civilization. And now it's just inventing identities. And these identities are unique in that they have no obligation for mutuality whatsoever. What makes Christianity so powerful, or frankly, any other civilizationalist ideology or identity so powerful, is there's always going to be the norm of mutuality, that we are expected to serve and bless one another. Wokeness has created this new caste system, and I think that's an insult to caste systems to even call it that. It's created this new caste system where you have identities placed on top who are under no obligation whatsoever to serve others. None. They are only to be served, and that's that. And if you say anything in any way that could even be remotely construed as offensive to them, you've committed heresy and you are to be excommunicated. So it is a very ugly faith, but it is unfortunately precisely the kind of postmodern cultural Marxist faith that's very natural in a world that's falling apart, in a world that's rotting. I think too, we don't want to underestimate the role of demography in this. When all said and done, secular liberals have stopped having kids, whereas Christian conservatives in the West and just religious conservatives in general are having more kids than ever, especially when you consider the mortality rates among children having dropped dramatically by 90%. So we're having more kids than ever. And that, scholars argue, that really contributed to the rise of the moral majority and the Reagan revolution, the Christian coalition in the 1980s, because back in the 1950s, about 70-80% of the church was Protestant liberal mainline denominations, Episcopals, you know, PCUSA, whenever they were technically formed, Methodists and the like. By the time you get to the 80s, it inverts. It's all of a sudden it's conservatives and evangelicals. And one of the reasons for that, it's not like there was all these mass conversions. No, one of the reasons for it is just they had kids and they raised their kids in the faith, and the kids tended to keep the faith into adulthood. You saw the rise of homeschooling in the 70s and 80s. You saw the rise of classical Christian education, particularly in the late 80s and 90s. And so all of this this demographic advantage that we still have, by the way, contributed to a growing, shall we call it, almost red state like or red county like feel and demographic in our country, so that blue states are basically collapsing and red states are rising.
That's true. I mean, now it comes at a little bit of a difficulty. Like we here in Tennessee, we have pretty significant immigration from places like Illinois and California, but mostly Illinois, mostly
they're called leftugees.
Yes. And a lot of them are tremendous. They've seen the result of bad policies. They would not like to pay more taxes. So they come to Tennessee and they vote against those policies and they vote against those taxes. But a lot of times there's cultural baggage that comes along. The other big difference that I think that we see between, say, the Rush Limbaugh years of cultural commentary, conservative commentary, and what we have now is Rush spent a lot of time on political stuff. There wasn't quite as much of that cultural side you see today.
That's right.
The culture war is much more visible. And as a result, I don't know that Rush, a movie had to be really extreme for Rush Limbaugh to stop talking about Congress to talk about what the movie was doing.
That's true.
I remember being a Christian, wanting to get into Christian filmmaking, and everyone being like, well, you just go make regular R-rated Hollywood movies, and and you being there on the set, that's your testimony. You don't send a message with the movie. Nobody does. Well, now everyone knows, like, Star Wars is completely politicized by Kathleen Kennedy. She's ruined Star Wars because of a specific agenda. Like, and it's not just conservative to talk about this. It's, if you would like to be a YouTuber who talks about movies, you will talk about this.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Rush, David Limbaugh, his brother, often talked about it, who's very overt evangelical Christian. And Rush avoided religion. He did not like to bring up religion, but that was the time. The times were 1990s.
Absolutely.
Height of the secular era, height of a unipolar world, one single power. We can reduce everything to political and economic system. That's all you need, just the right systems in place, which he argued, I think rightly so, was conservative systems, what Gingrich was arguing for, balanced budgets, sensible government, low taxes, and so on, muscular defense. The world is gone in many ways.
Right.
Yeah. Astonishingly, that world is gone. The unipolar world's gone. Now it's multipolar. It's exactly what I argued for the last 2 years, what's behind the whole situation with Russia and Ukraine. You can't understand it using old Cold War frames of reference of, oh, it's just old dumb KGB, you know, Gorbachev wannabe. And no, that's not what's going on there. You got,
You can no longer talk about wars as country versus country, because within most countries, the government is against its own people more than neighbors to the side in many instances. Yeah.
Where there's that vertical really hard. Impact. It's not the divide isn't horizontal. It's vertical, exactly. But with the rise of China, Russia, India, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran, I mean, the UAE, the power axis now is massive. And and the rise of BRICS, BRICS Plus, the economic union, the G7 aren't the only players in town anymore. So the world is changing dramatically, but moving ironically in the direction of nation, culture, custom and tradition.
So your recommendation, it sounds like what you're saying is the world is changing rapidly. We need to have more kids. search through the ancient traditions, sift through and find those things that really contributed to civilization, readopt those really important disciplines and skill sets. But that we do need to have a standard to know what that actually is, because everybody has a definition of civilization, even the people who are tearing stuff down at this very moment.
Yeah, ISIS.
Believe ISIS they're creating something.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Oh, I was thinking about people in Congress, actually.
not much of a difference.
But you're, what a world.
But you're right. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, that is so in a civilizationalist world, it's not going to be this one size fits all globalist technocratic system. It's if politics is downstream from culture, we're going to have lots and lots of different politics. And and so I think we have an amazing opportunity here in the United States, or just the Anglosphere in general, where we've got this amazing civilizational inheritance from Christendom, where Jerusalem, Athens, and Rome got synthesized through London and made its way over to Philly. I should call it Philadelphia. I don't know if they called it Philly back in the day, but
yeah.
And it created a nation that has become an epoch of liberty, the likes of which the world just has never seen before. And we're losing it. We're losing it to this, these woke globalist leftists who occupy both parties, who are more enamored with their own accumulation of wealth and power and affluence than they are preserving the republic. So we have an amazing opportunity to renew those republican values. Yeah. I think we're seeing it in red states. I mean, you mentioned, so you're just showing off with Tennessee here. I'm in Delaware. I'm 20 minutes from Biden's basement, for heaven's sake. But you mentioned, interestingly enough, even here, we're in many respects a Second Amendment sanctuary. I could go into a gun shop right now and walk out with a Glock 40 caliber, no problemo, none whatsoever. Whereas I grew up in Connecticut, I don't even know if you can buy Glocks anymore up in Connecticut, for heaven's sake.
Connecticut's rough, yeah.
Yeah, Connecticut's rough. Yeah, Vermont isn't, but that's the mean. The gun enthusiast culture. I don't know if you ever read Abigail Cohn's Shooters. Did you ever read that?
Oh, I've heard about it. I haven't read it. I know roughly the concept. Yes.
Yeah, it's a fascinating read. It's published by the University of Berkeley too. That's what they talk about.
I need to get that irony.
Yeah, but it is totally pro gun culture. It's 100%, and she points out that it is in many respects. It is a traditionalist culture that transcends red and blue. It transcends, you know, you got gays and lesbians in it. You got women in it. You got men, red states. But so here, even in Delaware, even though we're liberal in almost every other way, ironically, you cannot touch our guns. Don't even come near it. So it transcends, ironically, this red, blue animosity in such a way that I actually think gun culture provides a supermajority paradigm for bringing us together to reimagine our society in light of and through the prism of a timeless tradition.
Yeah. And I feel like it is a fascinating intersection of a bunch of things, because it intersects with manufacturing freedoms. Guns are not only are guns, you know, throughout history, a technological driver, but just the ability to make guns at home. If you can make a modern firearm, then you're doing good metalwork. Like, this is a good thing to have spread around and decentralized. But it's also a great ideological kind of litmus test, because when we talk about firearm freedom, and then you talk about losing firearm freedom, you can pretend like you're only having a conversation about hunting hobbies, but you can't really have a deep conversation about firearm freedom without talking about those intrinsic rights, without talking about whether or not people are allowed to oppose a government that is over them, without talking about how you would oppose a tyrannical government. So guns are an intersection of so many really important aspects of freedom.
Knitting,
Just such a phenomenal place to be. And culturally as well, just the fact that, we've been talking about the big technological players and how much they control information. YouTube and Instagram have done more to spread gun culture and make stuff discussable. Wow. Like back in, you know, we've been talking about it, and kind of like the good old days when Gingrich was doing this and Rush was doing that. Guns were not very cool back then.
No,
I knew so many people who owned guns and would never talk about them because they didn't want to get put on a list and they didn't want to do this. Now, thanks to YouTube and Instagram, most people my age, you buy a gun, what's the first thing you do with it? Background check. Mm-hmm. Second thing you do with it, take pictures, put them on Instagram so people can see your cool gun. It has changed the way that people talk about firearms immeasurably. So,
don't you think too, the 2020 race riots? That's when I think, and then defunding the police. That's when it noticed in my family, the younger, bluer side of, our family, all of a sudden all became pro Second Amendment after that. They were like, there's no way I'm going to subject my safety to the whims of a woke city council.
I think that's a big factor. And it wasn't just firearms. One of the trends that we've seen at SHOT Show is there is a trend away from hunting stuff towards more tactical stuff for civilians. The number of booths that are selling whatever product and they have a mannequin wearing night vision and body armor in the booth, astronomical, because that's cool. Yeah. You want to see that in a booth, and you go up and you find out that they sell a trigger upgrade. But you want to sell it in this particular guise, not with a hunter with a elk on his back. You know, you're selling a more of a particular message because people are more interested in the home defense and some of these other capabilities. Yeah. Some of that's global war on terror stuff, but some of that is just the development of YouTube and Instagram. But also I would say, I don't want to give you the exact numbers on air. I'll tell them to you after. But in 2020, when the riots kicked off, we had started selling body armor, ceramic rifle plates. I think it was almost 6 or 8 months prior. And they were just trickling slowly off the shelves. It's expensive. It's heavy. It's not really normalized. People don't really want body armor that stops rifle plates, that's that uncomfortable to wear. Well, all of a sudden, in the summer of 2020, body armor started flying off the shelves. Wow. And obviously, there was a huge spike during that summer of peace and love. But the the after the spike, the new normal is body armor is a very big part of our business. Wow. The ambient normal sales of body armor is extremely high. And that tells you something.
Yes.
It's very easy to buy a shotgun or a revolver and put it in a closet just in case, but body armor is expensive. It's not fun to wear. Right. You are thinking on a whole different level. Body armor. So it's, I think that's another great, litmus test or thermometer indicator. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. Oh, I'd love to go to a gun show with you. I feel like a kid in the candy store. I just learned so much. It'd be awesome.
I'm trying to, pick up on some of these indicators. One of the great things about T-Rex, let's go back to the main topic, which is conservative commentators. I love the fact that there's more of them. I love the fact that there's more variety. I love the fact that amongst the conservative commentators, there is a conversation about all of life and the culture war. But there is a little bit of a weakness that I see. You can make good enough money being a cultural commentator that kind of becomes your whole gig. And then you're a little bit separated from real life. And you have kind of the same problem that academia does.
Yeah.
And I am so grateful for the fact that T-Rex, we have our fingers in a bunch of different pots. So we have this podcast, we have a YouTube channel, but we also sell products. We also develop products. So we're hearing from a lot more people and we're, I think have a little bit more insight into this and we're a business. There's a bunch of folks who I really appreciate their opinion on a lot of stuff, but when they start talking about business, I can't help but notice that they only sell bumper stickers. So there's a lot of business stuff that they're not touching on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And I wish they would go a little deeper or see this other thing here. So I feel tremendously blessed that we are as stretched. Sometimes it's too much.
Yeah.
We are as stretched as we are because it feels like There's a lot more to learn and to gather. If we're doing manufacturing and running this type of business and we're involved in this industry, and it's super fun because I feel like we have a little bit more of a holistic approach. Is that something that sort of, I would say, needs to be the future of cultural commentary? We're talking about movies, so that's great. We're talking about culture, so that's great. Are there other areas where we conservative commentators, is there an area that's lacking where some listener, the next generation of conservative thinkers, you know, probably on your podcast, possibly on mine, the next Rush Limbaugh could be listening to us right now. Yeah. What's the thing, you know, what's the next blind spot that we can cover? What's the thing that we're really going to need to handle really well and nail?
Well, fortunately, I think it's happening a lot, but I do think it's something akin to what we call a parallel economy rising up. You know, because again, going back to the Reformation example, you know, the reformers weren't able to break free from the feudalized medieval world without building their own parallel institutions.
Right.
So you got to build. And now it takes a while, right? You didn't see Protestant scholasticism really for another 100 years. It took a while before you had these Protestant universities churning out top-notch Protestant thinkers who could all come together and start putting together these confessions of faith for they remember all the nation states that are popping up there are confessional, are confessional states. So, to me, I think that's the big one. I'll be speaking later on this week at Replatform Vegas, and that's what it's focused solely on building the parallel economy, but really focusing on building the infrastructure for the parallel economy. Because so you know, you need payment processors, you need all these things that may not be very sexy, but are absolutely indispensable to as a hedge against debanking and the like. So I would say, if you know, think about, again, I love what you're doing. I love what Dan Bongino's actually been a bit on the front lines there with parallel economy stuff. I mean, don't just think in terms of ideologies or, you know, lofty liberal arts sort of, you know, truth, goodness, and beauty. Those are, I've devoted my life to that. But also think exactly what you were talking about at the beginning. Think in terms of the servile arts. What can you bring? What skills do you have that you can bring onto the parallel economy market that other patriots can benefit from so they're not dependent on a woke economy's offering of that very skill? We are becoming more and more creatures of what's called consumer politics, where we boycott and we boycott. You know, just ask Bud Light about consumer politics.
Sure.
I don't think they're going to want to talk about it anytime soon. But one of the things that we forget is there was a fellow who put. What was it? Something like ultra right or something? A beer that he did a couple of commercials for, put it out there. Dude, he made over $1 million in just a few months, just as a statement for people to tell Bud Light, right? So that's the boycott. People will buy from you if they see that you share and championing their values as opposed to belittling them, mocking them, and demeaning them. So we're becoming much more of a consumer politics culture where we intentionally buy in accordance with shared values. Mm-hmm. So you don't even need to have, you know, a quote superior product. You just have to be, you have to show you're one of us, and that's it. And we'll buy from you. We love to do it. I love talking with you more than I would BBC because I don't share their values. I don't like them. Yeah. They're creeps. They're weird. Whereas I would rather spend an hour and a half with someone who I know loves truth, goodness, and beauty, loves faith, family, and freedom, and we can together strengthen it. And so I think a parallel economy. And then, of course, that means anything and everything. That's the beauty of it. Whatever your talents are, tap into them. Learn to market them. I love what you said. Yeah, don't just create, you know, bumper stickers or t-shirts. Those are great. But that's just where it begins. You need to start creating industries. And if you go there, man, sky's the limit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can vouch for the fact that we do have a functioning business at T-Rex is what makes everything else possible. Our YouTube channel is completely demonetized. Kind of doesn't matter because we have a different way of generating economic income. And, it's kind of unpleasant because if you want to build a parallel economy, there's all kinds of tools. There's some amazing e-commerce platforms that we can't use because the gun industry is banned from them. There's some really cool payment processors. Like, we're banned from PayPal. Their fraud protection was amazing. We saved so much money by them protecting us until they kicked us out in the street. So you will have to take, you'll need to have a willingness to pay a little bit of a tax, for lack of a better word. There will be some hurdles for you. There will be some in some ways, though, you'll end up, I would say that in many ways, T-Rex Arms, we're in this somewhat unpleasant, somewhat discriminated against industry, the firearm industry. And yet it is such a healthy industry at certain times. There were times in 2020 when other companies were just falling like flies because they were supported by all these other pieces of infrastructure that failed. And T-Rex Arms and many other firearm industry companies, those are companies that do well in good times because there's a recreational component, and they do well in bad times because there's another component. And so, there will be obstacles and difficulties, and but I think climbing up the steep side of the mountain really has its perks a lot of the time, for sure.
It does. Yeah, no, that's very, very well said. Yeah, we've faced demonetization as well. And then that's, there is a theory out there that all the great innovations that have happened historically are all the result of problem solving. And what's the prerequisite to that? Well, you got to have a problem. So the genius, the imaginative genius doesn't tend to operate when you're sipping pina coladas in Bermuda. It tends to operate when, we just got demonetized. How are we going to pay the bills next year? We got to figure out a viable business model here, or else we're not eating. Well, then that's going to create some ingenuity right there.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you giving us your time, but also I really enjoyed the conversation. I got some book recommendations I'm going to go dig into and read, and I'm looking forward to seeing
I got mine, my John Buchanan. Oh, that's great. Yeah, right back at you. Thank you.
It's going to be, we're heading into an interesting but fascinating future. I am optimistic in the long term. I think the short term is going to be tough.
Yeah, short term is really very turbulent. Yeah,
yeah. I'm looking forward to standing side by side with a bunch of people. Some of them will be folks that we've known for a long time, but I also anticipate a bunch of new people standing up as things go on. So eager to see what that next generation of conservative commentators look like, what skills they bring to the table. It's going to be neat.
That'd be fascinating, that's for sure.
Very good. Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Turley, and I will give you some secret body armor statistics as soon as I end recording.
Awesome.